The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, along with Tim McKenna.
Finally. It's been how many weeks and you stuttered? You almost had it.
I'm working on it, you know.
Welcome to November, huh?
Oh, no. It's still September. Oh, no, it's October. That's right. This is the month of October, as we say. It does.
It's been that kind of week, you know, the rainy, the chilly.
Right.
But it's gone back up to 75, so we're good.
I know. It's going to be nice. Hey, how are you, number one?
I'm excellent.
Okay. Well, I have something new about Shelley.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody around the country evidently has been following Shelley Snyder. A couple of weeks ago, she was on her way from Cleveland to Montana, was hit by a vehicle. Was put into an induced coma, and they brought her home this week. She is at Metro Health, which is a big trauma center here in downtown Cleveland. Unbelievable outpouring of support and love for this woman. Unbelievable. They started out with a very modest GoFundMe campaign, which went over its goal in the first, like, hour. And they are close to $80,000 as of now. It was a big chunk to get her back here. They had to have a plane and a team of doctors and nurses and special equipment. But she is back. I believe she's going to be okay. But I have a really cool story to add to that. So You might remember that people were kind of standing around when the accident happened, and a woman stopped, told her son to stay in the car, and came over and sat on the ground with Shelley, holding her hands. If you read the story, I mean, it made you cry. Holding her hands and saying, just keep breathing. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to come, you know, we're going to take care of you. And it took about 10 to 12 minutes for the ambulance to get there. For some reason, they couldn't get a helicopter up. So they had to come by land, you know, on the road. Well, the woman's name is Bethany Udy. She's a veterinarian. And I sent her a thank you just because I thought it was an amazing thing. I don't know if I would have had the courage to sit on the pavement with a woman that horribly, you know, injured and just hope that she would survive until the ambulance got there. Do you know that Bethany actually sent me a note back this week saying that she just could not believe the outpouring of love for Shelley? She said it was just amazing to her. She did go to the hospital before she left Montana and saw Shelley again. So I just want another really, you know, sort of tip of the helmet to Bethany Udy, Dr. Udy, for being such an amazing person. And Shelley, who can't receive visitors, you can check up on her at GoFundMe.com and look up Shelley Snyder. Not necessarily, you don't have to make a donation, but you can see all the updates. Somebody in Cleveland, Chris Alvarado, who's been on the show before, actually, is doing all of these updates. People have just been amazing. Amazing, amazing. So we have a big show this week. Did you know that?
Always big.
Okay, here we go. We're going to loosely paraphrase Mark Twain here. The reports of my retirement are greatly exaggerated. You know, so Mark Twain said the reports of my death. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. This is according to superstar cyclist Jeremy Powers. So evidently there's been a rumor spreading around by some journalists that this is going to be Jeremy's last season of racing the bike. He's going to retire. Tonight we're here to tell you it ain't so. He told me himself. Well, we'll let him tell you himself. He is arguably one of the most successful, popular riders in modern cycling. He's won over 60 UCI victories and 4 USA Cyclocross National Championships. He is the top-ranked American rider in the world. So who's making up stories about his retirement? That's what I want to know.
Not us.
No, we are not. Jeremy is also involved in an organization that helps young riders get into the sport, and including lowering the financial bar, because it is the expense of the sport that often keeps riders who would be superstars like he is from being able to move on. So we're going to let Jeremy tell you himself when he joins me in a moment. We're going to take a break. We're going to spend a few minutes then speaking with event director Charles Coyne. Next weekend, Brian and I will be joining Charles at the Recumbent CycleCon in Sharonville, Ohio. It's just north of Cincinnati. We'll check in with Charles to see what's new with the event. I'm excited. I get to go back to my hometown. You know, I was raised in Cincinnati. I'm sorry. That's what my dad used to say because he was from Philadelphia.
It's the Queen City, isn't it?
It is the Queen City. And in fact, when we were kids, we got to ride the, what was that paddle boat called? The River Queen?
The River Queen?
Yeah, something like that. And that was fun. So since this is KMC's CrossFest weekend, I thought it only fitting we should speak with one of the New England frame builders this week, too. What do you think?
Great idea.
Well, last night, Friday, the New England Builders Ball was the big feature opening the weekend of the festival. I thought we should find a really nice frame builder, and we did. Thanks to Eric Weiss, he turned me on to a guy named Niall Gangler of Pioneer Valley Frameworks, who is in the throes of moving, so like it's crazy for him. He was gracious enough to take some time to speak with me. He did his homework before plunging into frame building full time. He studied at Hampshire College. He went to the United Bicycle Institute. He learned how to do tie bikes. He went to the Serrata Fit Center. His frames run the gamut from road to cross to full-blown touring, and he even makes a randonneuring machine for brevets. We're going to find out all about the local guy with the international flair a bit later in the show. So let us welcome superstar cyclocross champion Jeremy Powers to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for taking time to speak with me today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. So here's the word on the street. You're retiring. Yeah. Is that BS or what?
Well, you know, No. I'm definitely not retiring. I think, I'm not exactly sure how that all probably got started. But, I mean, you know, the general thing that's happening in cyclocross right now is there's a lot of young riders coming up. And so the old, you know, 33 is not very old. That's how old I am. But it looks like, you know, I've gone through a couple of generations of cyclocross riders and racers. And so, obviously, a logical step that the media has been asking me a lot recently is when I'm, you know, going to hang it up. And just a recent article on Cycling Tips was, you know, dubbed it as the autumn of my cycling career, so like kind of the last hurrah. And I'm not surprised by that. It's totally fine, but I definitely, you know, I have a plan for the next at least 2 years and potentially a third year. So I'm not really focused on retirement quite yet.
I just think it's funny that rumors start and, you know, one person picks it up and it's sort of like when you played telephone as a kid and comes out the other end and it doesn't sound anything like what you thought it would.
Yeah, that is for sure. I've seen that happen 100 times, so I always try to go straight to the source. So I appreciate you asking me. And, yeah, the facts are the facts, and I'm not planning to retire, definitely not this year and definitely not next year. So.
Okay, you heard it here. So there. I would like to know how you came to be so interested in cyclocross, that became your focus.
Yeah, over the years, I trended towards, I've always had a pretty short attention span, even when I was really young. I was a classic kid in school that really couldn't pay attention. And later in my, like, you know, high school years, I would front load a lot of my classes so that I would do them in the morning, kind of on a fresh off sleep, and basically head right to class, kind of do my harder classes first thing in the morning, and then I would go home and train in the afternoons. And so I was really lucky to have that. And I noticed that when I was racing junior mountain bikes that the races that were an hour 20 minutes long, I would do really well in. And then mountain biking, because that's what I was doing when I first started off, it was, you know, the races started to go more towards an hour and 40, hour, 2 hours, 220, and that didn't suit me as well. And so really, you know, I raced on the road for a long time, and it was really great for my engine, but really any race that was over 100K or 3 hours, maybe 3:30. I really didn't do well in it, mainly because I just my attention span was shorter just genetically, and that was the gift that was given. So cyclocross has kind of always been the thing that I've really gravitated towards and had a lot of success in, you know, combining the technical aspects as well as the explosive power. And I've always loved it. I've always loved all of the little bits of it that are different than the other disciplines of cycling that I've done.
Well, you certainly have had a ton of success throughout your career with it. I have to say I was a little bit surprised to read your Instagram post a few days ago. I think listeners would be interested to hear about it because it shows that even the very best of cyclists, those who are trained well, who have tons of successes, experience bad days or bad situations. Tell us what happened in Iowa.
Yeah, so just to provide some context for the listeners, basically this was kind of the big week of cyclocross in the United States. We started off last weekend. There's a Category 1 race that's in that was at Trek headquarters in Waterloo, Wisconsin, which was last Sunday. So not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before that, where a lot of European riders hadn't been invited over, and Trek was sort of taking care of to have them come and race the United States. So that was sort of our first shot at racing against the Europeans on American soil, you know, in many years, probably, you know, at least at this clip. So we did, we had that first race, and in warm-up, I actually crashed pretty hard on my left rib cage and on my left arm, and I jumped up really quickly, sort of hoping that it wasn't going to be very much and that I was going to be able to walk it off, but I soon realized that that wasn't going to be the case. And I was almost immediately within, you know, an hour and the hours after that, I was very, very sore from basically the fall. And so that kind of led me to the World Cup in Las Vegas, which was that Wednesday after that. And then after that, we had Iowa. And so, yeah, by the time Iowa came, all of those injuries had sort of fully matured, I guess I'd say. And I was in quite a bit of pain and, you know, labored breathing and just the additional running that was on the course in Iowa versus something like Las Vegas. I was in a lot of pain and I was on the tail end of a head cold too. So I was just starting to get this head cold. Actually, it is the wrong way to say that, but basically I just had a head cold starting kind of at that same moment. And really just kind of a disastrous week of racing altogether. And it's too bad because the week before I had good form and I had actually won both days at the season opener in Rochester, New York. And so then, you know, you fast forward to 1 week later and I really had like just a terrible week of racing with an injury and then a head cold. And so, you know, it's kind of hard to believe so much has happened, but we're really only going into the third weekend of cyclocross season coming up. So
that's what's interesting is how huge this race schedule is. You know, it's all piled on in this very short period of time. How do you stay fresh and prepared and fit for so many events that are so close together?
Yeah, American cyclocross is a little different. Like the Europeans do take a more traditional approach, but they get very heavy in their season. You know, I would say more towards, you know, October, November, December, they have a lot of racing. In the United States, we really trend towards September, October, November are our strongest months. And then a lot of riders, you know, we do have some races in the beginning of December, big races, and then we have the national championships in January. But really, like, the last couple of weeks of December and then anything after nationals is really small. And so we all end up having or do end up racing over in Europe, the final World Cups and then the World Championships and sort of the season accumulate are kind of culminates at the end where the World Championships right at the first weekend of February. So how do you stay fresh? Really, for American cyclocross rider to come into the season in good condition in September is really important. And, you know, and then it's about taking kind of breaks and really knowing oneself to be able to, I would say, meter the outputs and really pick and choose where they want to put their energy in what events.
Do you subscribe to any particular diet? I know people always talk about food, so, you know, we ride to eat, right? So
right. Yeah, I've said that a lot. You know, I do find myself, I've tried many different diets, and as I have, you know, since the beginning of this conversation was about getting older, as I've gotten older, my diet has absolutely changed. You know, I think when you're younger, you can really, I would say, you know, digest carbohydrate really quickly, and almost nothing kind of phases you, you know, dairy, lactose, all of these things. And as you get older, you start to look for, I would say, improvements in other, like, in other ways, you know. So can I race this, you know, hour and 10-minute race in a different way? Can I race it, you know, do, if I'm not as good at the start, but I am really good at the finish, should I race, you know, thinking differently about it? Is my diet something that I can do? Can I get more in the gym and can I build up? These are all things. And so my diet has absolutely changed. I've trended towards less carbohydrate in the last year, I would say, you know, even at one point going into like a ketogenic type diet. Through the base season, but that didn't really yield the result that I wanted for my high end output. So I do have like a lot less sugar in my diet overall, and that's been really good for me. I have I feel like mental clarity. I feel really good, and I think that I have plenty of available, I guess, carbohydrate or like glycogen storage, if you will. So I feel great on the bike, and I think I've made good decisions about my diet. And in general, I try to eat things that are good for you. And so if I see something in my diet, you know, I track it every, you know, a couple times a month, just do like a small, you know, basically like MyFitnessPal. I just kind of enter in what I'm eating. And then if I see things that just don't look like they're really nutritious, I try to, you know, kind of remind myself that that's not a good use of calories at this point. Because really when you're a cyclist, you have to be, you know, a high-end cyclist. You really need to be thinking about every calorie that you eat and what its benefit to you is. So,
all good advice, I would say. So yeah. we're going to actually talk about a couple of other things. But one of the things I wanted to know was, I've seen it for years and years and years, that cyclists especially seem to undermine their own successes sometimes. And I'm wondering if you think that that's so and what might cause that.
Well, give me an example of what you mean, and then I'll jump on it.
Okay, like, here's the guy who in training is just the fastest, and he always knows when to shift, what to do. Gets out in a race, drops his chain. I mean, just seems to not be able to come across the line.
Sure.
You know, in the front. Do you know what I'm saying? Kind of.
Definitely. Yeah, and I think a lot of riders, you know, sometimes we'll say like, you know, I'll joke with like friends, like, man, their head fell off.
Oh, okay. That's a good way to put it.
You know, like headless horsemen out there. But, you know, I think for a lot of riders, there is a mental component to it that is really hard to overcome and is something that I feel as though I've had a lot of opportunities to race at the highest end. So when I speak for myself, I feel comfortable when I line up for a World Cup and I've been able to execute at that level. Many times, whether or not my fitness has been there or whether I've been struggling through a long season with a lot of travel, I kind of file those in different folders. But I would say for a lot of riders, you know, you really do go through different steps in your career, and looking at those things and being honest and having a lot of like self-awareness around, am I actually kind of sabotaging myself, sort of like what you said, by not really addressing this fear or this underlying cause that's, you know, having me make bad decisions in the race, whether that's erratic shifting or not knowing like a speed limit coming into a turn and then end up crashing, or, you know, not, you know, getting to the race with enough time and being stressed out. A lot of things come into being a good rider and a complete rider. And so I always really, you know, those are the kinds of things that when you become a pro, you know, you hope that you've learned. And some riders have so much talent that they turn pro really quickly. And that's the type of stuff that when you hear riders say, yeah, I stayed one more year in the amateur so I could learn more, or I stayed one more year in the United States with this team so that I could learn more, like a 20-year-old staying on, you know, like Axel Merckx's program. That's a good thing, because when you get to the pro tour, that stuff doesn't fly. They don't look at you and think, oh, yeah, I'd really like to like, get you in with a mental coach so that you can work on this thing, or like we can talk about your diet. No, it's like you're there to perform and you're being paid, you know, to do a job and to execute. So, I guess that would be my advice, is like making sure that you're the full package, and knowing and having that self-awareness around where your weaknesses are is a really valuable thing in life and also as a cyclist, for sure.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with superstar Jeremy Powers. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I want to ask you something that I think is really important to the health of cycling in general. It's an expensive sport to get into. You have an organization, a cycling foundation called JAM, J-A-M. I want to know what it is and what it does, because I think it addresses that particular question for maybe some future superstars who find it very daunting to get into the sport.
Absolutely, yeah. And so JAM is an acronym from the first names of my two best friends, Alec and Mukunda. So Jeremy, Alec, and Mukunda is what, you know, the acronym is JAM. And it's just JAM Cycling Fund. And essentially JAM is, I very simply sometimes say that it is organization that like kicks down the financial barriers that are, you know, like inherent in cycling, right? And we know this because it's, you can go out and buy a pair of running shoes or buy, you know, a baseball and a glove or whatever. These are much less expensive sports to get into. Whereas cycling, you know, there isn't a barrier of entry for sure. And so I think I was very lucky in being able to, I would say, self-promote and really like put myself out there. There was, if I wanted to be on a team or I wanted the manager of the team, whether it worked out or not, to know who I was, I talk a lot. So even when I was younger, it was worse. So I would be at the races and I would be just like clawing at these people. Just like, hey, John, this was the owner of the team, the mountain bike team, Team Devo that I was part of. Hey, John, I'm Jeremy Powers. Like immediately after the race, I got 29th today and I'm 13th, you know, in the expert category. And so these types of things, like really putting yourself out there and really, I say self-promotion. And I think a lot of people look down on that, but in this sport, really, you have to self-promote. You have to talk about your accomplishments, or you have to talk about your desire to get in that place. JAM Fund takes a lot of what Alec and McKenna and I have learned from life as cyclists, and just life skills across the board, whether that's cooking rice for yourself and making eggs in the morning before the race, or that's like, you know, knowing how to register and, you know, sign yourself up for a massage locally or whatever, like all of these things. We sort of have a formula for the JAM Fund that we've passed down to other riders. And I think we've turned 6 riders here in our little area of Massachusetts professional, and they all live and train here. And we've created a community. And really deep down, I think that we just genuinely like helping people. And we really want to see other people succeed. And, you know, for a long time, that was our passion, was to see JAM Fund fully through, to make sure that other riders had the same opportunities and that, you know, money and logistics and travel and stuff like that, that we could help and give back in that way. And so we've had some success with it. We're not done by any stretch with JAM. It's been a great run. We're starting to really see some, I would say, the fruit of that tree kind of starting to bear, because Stephen Hyde has been riding really well, and he's a rider that came from that. You know, he just raced to 10th in Iowa at the World Cup. Ellen Noble is leading the under-23 World Cup right now, and she is a product of that. Jeremy Duren's a product of that. Anthony Clark, and there's others. So it's been such a great thing to do, and I say that it's way bigger than me. I have a small role in it. You know, I do a part of it, but really Alec is really the heart of that program. He takes all the riders to the races, and he helps them, and together we create, you know, what is JAM. And so it's been really special to have that impact in our little community and in the cyclocross community in general.
Well, it's obvious that it's a give back, and, you know, giving back, paying it forward, those are all important things. And I think it makes a lot of sense in cycling because it's such a tough sport. You know, there are a lot of components to it that a lot of people don't see. You know, oh, you just jump on a bike and ride. No, it's not that easy. So,
yeah, and I'll just add really quickly, like I've always said, you know, and some people really hold these secrets, I would say, close to their chest because they really don't want it to get out there. And it's so hard, as you said, to make it in cycling that really, like, it's, if you know us, it's we're an open book, and really everything we know, all the training, all the nutrition, everything that we do, we really give it all to the riders so that they can make it, because we believe we have a formula that's at least strong. You know, we don't say like the best, but even giving them all the information, it would be so hard for them to make it. So we understand that, and we really try to make great riders and in general, great people out of from the JAM Fund. So
yeah, I think that's really cool. Great people. You know, it's true that you are a rider, but before that, you are a human being. So, where are you headed after KMC? I mean, I know it's a huge season. You're heading for World Cup stuff, right?
Yep. So I'll do in theory. I mean, I'm battling off a little bit of a head cold and some bruised ribs. Luckily, I just came out of the doctor's office and they're not broken, so I'm pretty happy to get that. So it's just going to be some time there with some pain, but not broken, which is great. So yeah, I guess KMC is TBD, to be determined whether or not I'll be able to line up. I won't know until Saturday. After that, for sure, 100%, I'm going to do Baltimore, which is the Charm City race. It's a Category 1 race there on Saturday. I'll be racing. Sunday I'll be racing there in Charm City. And then I'm going to come back and we'll do a one day at Gloucester. And then the next couple days after that, Ellen and I will both travel to the World Cup in the Netherlands, which is in Valkenburg. And then we come back and we have the Pan American Championships, which is in Cincinnati. We do 2 days of racing there. And it kind of just continues from there. Louisville. And then we have a trip back to Europe after that, 2 weeks after that. So, it's very fast-paced.
Yeah, I was hoping that Cincinnati would be closer to next weekend because that's Recumbent CycleCon's down there, and I'm going to be down there. I would be able to catch up with you, but that's not going to work. So these are going to be the silly questions. What's your favorite food?
I really love breakfast. So, you know, eggs in a thousand different ways with some vegetables, maybe some bacon sometimes, avocados, things like that. Breakfast is easily the meal that I look forward to every day the most because I think I'm starving when I go to sleep. So I'm like, I can't wait to wake up and eat something.
That's funny because I like breakfast too. And you can have breakfast anytime, you know. You don't have to have breakfast in the morning.
I know. That always gets me at the races, the diners. They always get me.
Right. Exactly. So what's your favorite kind of music? Do you play? I mean, I obviously you probably listen to music when you train. What's your favorite kind of music?
Yeah, I would say a younger version of myself. I always wished I had gone to like a lot of the music festivals and kind of been out there doing that type of, I don't know, just like partying, like hanging out with friends, you know, enjoying yourself and just seeing like live music shows. I never did that because I was always so focused on my racing. So I listened to a lot of live sets from a lot of DJs and electronic DJs. And there's a lot of big festivals, especially, you know, in the States now and in Europe. So I download a lot of those live sets and I listen to them and I kind of just, I go with that. I love old school hip hop, like depending on what it is. I was a really big fan of DJ AM before he passed away and I listened to a lot of his sets. When I'm training, I still do. They're just classics in the DJ world. So, I would say I'm a little like, I don't listen to classical music, but, one thing I did do this year that's probably interesting is I started listening to a lot of podcasts and a lot of book on tape. And so, yeah, I think I listened to instead of, you know, as much music, I probably listened to hundreds of hours of podcasts and books this year, which was a big change for me.
So, well, maybe eventually you'll add mine to your list.
That's right. I'm
that
definitely
would be nice.
Getting familiar with yours.
Yeah. So the last thing I have to ask has to do with my favorite topic besides bicycles. Do you have a pet?
I do. Yeah. My dog is a yellow lab. He's 5 years old. His name is Moose. Also goes by Monster. Crazy man, a lot of things, but he is a, you know, classic, like purebred Labrador. He's a total crazy, you know, he's total crazy, but he has a good temperament and he's not like wild, like he doesn't, you know, he's not doing crazy things. He's well mannered, but gosh, we love him. And when you get a dog, I hate to say this, but like, you always know, like, man, I'm going to love this. Like, I love this guy.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah. It's, for sure. I look forward to every time I get to hang with him. And just even last night, just like, you know, sick. He just wants to nuzzle, like put his head underneath your armpit and just watch TV with you. And it's just a, you know, man's best friend, if you will.
That is so true. That
yeah,
is so
always
true.
Always excited to come home and be with the dog and my wife, Emily, as well.
Well, and your dog will always love you forever and ever and ever and ever. Is always happy to see you. Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. Good luck. I hope those ribs heal up. And good luck with the World Cup races, all the races. And have a wonderful season.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you for having me. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Take care of yourself.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Jeremy Powers joined me from his home in Massachusetts. What a great guy. Everybody I have ever heard mention his name says the same thing. We are going to take a quick break. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Charles Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are T-minus 1 week from Recumbent CycleCon 2016. How are you? Are you freaking out yet?
I'm doing well, Diane. Thank you for asking. No freaking out on our end. Everything's pretty much under as much control as you can have this far out. So things are going well. We've got a lot of exciting exhibits for people to come and see, and got some new and exciting bikes and trikes that are being introduced at the show. So there will be a lot of excitement going on at the show.
So fill us in a little bit on the scope. It's at the Sharonville Convention Center right outside of Cincinnati. This will be my second year there. Tell us a little bit about who some of the exhibitors are and what we might expect to see.
Well, the Sharonville Convention Center is just north of downtown Cincinnati, about 15 minutes north of downtown Cincinnati. So it's kind of in the northern Cincinnati suburbs. It'd take quite a bit of time to list all the recumbent manufacturers who are going to be there, but most of them will be, I'll just go down real quick, if that's okay, alphabetically, with Azub, Bachetta, CapTrike, Cruise Bike, HP Velotechnic, Haze, Ice, Lightning, Linear, Schlitter Bikes, and Sunseeker, Titrikes, Trident, Triot, as well as accessory people like Schwalbe Tires, FSA, make the cranks and that sort of thing, Velocity Wheels, several of the different rack and carrier companies. So pretty good spread of bikes and recumbent bikes and trikes to be seen this year. As well as we have the Bicycle Tour and Travel Expo portion of the show. Right. And so we have some new exhibitors there. Jamis Bicycles will have bicycles. Two Terrain, which is a touring bicycle, and Link, which is a light touring bicycle. So.
Oh, wait, is Neil coming?
Yes. Cycle Monkey with the name's skipping my tongue right now.
Oh, Roloff.
Roloff, yeah. There you go. Right.
Yeah. I'm really interested to see the Link bikes. That's going to be very cool. They were introduced at Interbike, so that's really,
exactly.
Really cool. So let me ask you, one of the cool things about Recumbent CycleCon is that people can come, bring a helmet, sign a release form, and actually ride these bikes outside. And it was so cool watching all these people zooming around on your track last year. So I assume we're going to be able to do the same thing this year.
Well, the same thing, only new and improved and better. Last year, we had a smaller track than would be ideal. So this year we have two separate larger tracks in the same area of the parking lot. And then what we'll have is we'll have one track that will be used for trikes, and then another track that will be used for the two-wheeled recumbents and bikes.
Wow, that's cool.
Well, when you get a lot of bikes out there, as you saw, it got a little too crowded, and the trikes don't, it's just easier to keep them separate than have them mixed together. So, the cornering rates and turning rates are different between the trikes and the bikes.
Yeah,
so,
I kind of remember some people taking the trikes out to a different part of the parking area. I do remember that now that I'm thinking about it. Do you see any new trends in recumbents?
Well, I've been hearing that for a long time, and still to a large degree, trike sales were dominant. But I've heard that two-wheeled recumbent bike sales are on kind of a resurgence too. So that's good. There are some really very high quality recumbents out there, and in fact, we have two brand new companies coming from one from Canada and one from Norway. Velotegra is, and both are interestingly front wheel drive recumbent bikes, not trikes, recumbent bikes, with front wheel drive using internally geared hubs of one type or another. So real interested to see how they ride. I've seen pictures of them and that sort of thing, but real anxious to see those ride. So one is Velotegra, and the other one is Curvelo.
Cool. Well, yeah. You also have seminars and workshops that are scheduled. Tell us a little bit about those. I know that Friday is actually, and we need to make sure that people understand this. Friday is an industry day. The actual show open to consumers is Saturday and Sunday, and we'll give them more information before we sign off here. But what are some of those seminars and workshops that are scheduled that the consumer will be able to see on Saturday and Sunday?
Right. Well, and like you said, Friday is our dealer-only day, and so that's the day that the dealers can meet with the representatives from all the recumbent manufacturers and talk about business. And so dealers are welcome Saturday and Sunday as well, of course, but Friday is the big day for dealers, and then Friday evening we have the recumbent industry dinner. So probably, the dealers can look on the website for those seminars. But on the weekends for the consumers, we've got a real nice cross-section and some extraordinary presenters, including yourself. But just as I won't go into a lot of detail, but just the names of some of the seminars that people might find of interest is Selling a Used Recumbent, Here's How. And that's Brian Ball from BentRider Online will be providing that one. Accessorizing Your Ride, Pat France with TerraCycle, T-Cycle, has a lot of different accessories and that sort of thing, and he knows good, clever ways of installing things and saving money and saving time. We've got a real interesting seminar called Adaptive Cycling, How Do You Fit In? And that is for folks who, Diane, as you know, especially the recumbent trikes, are very adaptable for people who have various physical challenges. And so over the years, that's become kind of a niche within the niche of the show. We get a lot of people who have adaptive needs come into the show looking at the equipment. So we'll have a whole seminar based on that premise. And that kind of addresses both consumers and dealers, because some dealers are very interested in working with the adaptive cycling community, so that should be a very popular seminar. And then we also have and this is where you fit in, our touring tips for newbies, and you can talk about what you plan to talk about there in that seminar. And then we have a physician who's going to talk about cycling and pain management, and not such an issue so much with recumbents because they are so comfortable to ride, but you still, as you get old, you do have aches and pains that Dr. Bateman has some strategies to address those sorts of things. And then on Sunday, we will pretty much repeat those seminars for the people that can only attend Saturday or Sunday.
Well, let's tell people where they can find the information, the show dates again, and the times.
Okay, well, the information is kind of a long name, but it's recumbentcyclecon.com.
Okay, and it's next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. That is October
7, 8, and 9.
Time does the show open on Saturday?
On Saturday, it opens from 9 to 5, and Sunday is 10 to 4.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you and seeing all of our buddies. We met a lot of nice people last year, including Mina Thorgerson, who's coming back this year, I understand, from Ridgeland, Mississippi.
Absolutely. The Ridgeland Tourism Board.
Right. So we had a lot of fun. We ended up going down to Ridgeland, Brian and I, and riding the tandem tour.
Excellent.
Yeah. So that was kind of cool.
They have really blossomed as an event down there. I don't remember how many they had the first year, but they about tripled in size from the first year to the second year. So that's very exciting.
There were 43 of us that took off on Saturday, so it was really, really fun. It was a lot of fun. Well, Charles, I'm looking forward to seeing you. Thank you so much for talking to us about Recumbent CycleCon. We'll post everything on Facebook and Twitter, and have a safe trip out. We'll see you there.
Okay, appreciate that. And one other item, if people are interested in the bicycle tour and travel expo portion of the show, then go to that website, bicycletourandtravelexpo.com.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, Dan, thank you very much.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And Charles Coyne joined me. I think he's still out on the West Coast at his place. He's also the publisher of Recumbent and Tandem Writer, which is a quarterly that comes out about tandems and recumbents. Big show if you like recumbents.
Would you say that recumbents are on the incline or holding steady or?
We're going to find out. I was shocked at how many people showed up with helmets in hand and went and test rode those. And I think that they did pretty well. The people who showed up did really, really well. Yeah.
Good to hear.
Yeah. Well, and we'll see people down there in Sharonville, Ohio next weekend. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to take a real quick break.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On Saturday, October 9th, from noon till 4 p.m., you can enjoy the sights, smells, and tastes of autumn in Northeast Ohio at Lake Metroparks Penitentiary Glen Reservation. Journey through fall colors, get creative with a craft, learn how wildlife prepare for the coming season, or hike one of the many park trails. Free to all ages welcome. Penitentiary Glen Reservation is at 8668 Kirtland Chardon Road in Kirtland. More info at lakemetroparks.com. Click on events.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Got it right.
Yep. And I'm Tim McKenna.
Yes, you are. What is our news?
So we always try to update the listeners when there is a recall on bikes. And this headline caught my attention. Advanced Sports International recalls bicycles due to fall hazard.
Wait, so if you fall off your bike, they're going to recall it?
Well, that's kind of what I thought. It was just kind of odd that the way they phrased it. But anyway, the product is Breezer and Fuji bicycles. The hazard, top clamp of the seat post can crack, posing a fall hazard to the user.
Ah,
remedy?
I see.
Replace. Consumers should immediately stop riding the bicycles and take their bicycle to a local Breezer or Fuji bicycle dealer or contact
ASI.
Yeah, ASI.
Oh, so I have a question. Do they list any specific model or is it all Fujis and all Breezers?
Yes, they do. There are 3,000 units that are affected. And this recall involves the ASI 2017 models.
Ooh, brand new.
Aluminum bicycles come in various colors. Seat posts are silver or black. Model name printed on the frame. Recall model. And there's about 15 of them listed. But 2017 model is what you're looking for.
This comes from Yahoo News. Chris Froome, cycling's therapeutic use exemption system, quote, is open to abuse, end quote. So if you've been following this, you know that Sir Bradley Wiggins sort of got his panties in a bunch. Three-time Tour de France winner Chris Froome has warned that therapeutic use exemption system is open to abuse. Froome's comments come in the wake of revelations that Sir Bradley Wiggins, Froome's former teammate at Team Sky, obtained TUEs before three major races, the 2011 and 2012 Tour de France, including the Giro d'Italia of 2013. There's no suggestion that Wiggins, who won the 2012 Tour, is also Britain's most decorated Olympian of all time, contravened anti-doping regulations. But his timing of the use of the drug taken via intramuscular injection for asthma and pollen allergies has highlighted the potential gaps in the TUE system as well as the ethics of using otherwise banned substances to treat illness. On the Andrew Marr show on Sunday, and this article appeared September 28th, Wiggins said that triamcinolone allowed him to compete on a level playing field. So that's an interesting comment that he would say on a level playing field, because that was the exact same sort of thinking that Lance Armstrong had. You know, we're all doping. It's a level playing field.
Right.
A lot of controversy because this has to do with asthma and breathing-induced illnesses. So I'm not sure where it's going to go.
And we've talked about this in the past with asthma. There's a higher rate of cyclists taking asthma drugs.
Right.
Because just of their environment, it would seem, and athletes. But, you know, I think when they find something that works, they tend to stick with it to level that playing field.
Exercise-induced asthma, which is a diagnosis. I don't know if it's really a higher number of athletes or if they're using that as a reason. I mean, that becomes the question. Are we using it as an excuse so that we can, you know, do these TUEs or not? I don't know. We're right. You know, it seems like we're heading right back that down that same dark alley.
There's always an opportunity to try and find something better. And the pharmacologists and athletes and everybody, they're going to go that way.
Yep.
10 years after its formation, the Tour de Saint-Louis may not be on the cycling calendar in 2017, with a lack of funds reportedly forcing the men's race to be canceled. So says Argentinian journalist Marcelo Lagatina, who tweeted that the 11th edition of the race will be called off because of budgetary concerns. The race has traditionally attracted many of the professional Peloton's best climbers and sprinters, with a mix of mountains and flat stages in a less intense environment than its World Tour calendar rival, the Tour Down Under. While many of the leading World Tour riders have decided to start their seasons in Argentina in recent years, the race has played host to some of the memorable performances by local riders. Here's a little bit of the good news. Reports suggest that the women's Tour de Saint-Louis will go ahead as planned in January. Having secured sufficient funding from other sponsors and organizers, are hoping to resurrect the men's race in 2018. So it's good to see that the women weren't the ones that were chopped just to keep the men around.
Exactly. That's cool. Women can still race. Men can't. All right. This comes from my favorite online wire service, Endurance Sports Wire. Performance bicycle recognized for enhancing the shopping experience. I thought this was interesting. Number one specialty bicycle retailer in the U.S. awarded for seamless integration of online sales channel and brick and mortar business. So this, of course, is the big, you know, brouhaha among bicycle retailers.
Right.
How to compete with online. Evidently, Performance has figured it out. Performance Bicycle, the number one choice for people who love to ride, has been acknowledged as the best omni-channel retailer by Interbike, the largest bicycle industry trade show in North America. The 2016 Interbike Award recognizes the unparalleled shopping experience that Performance Bicycle provides by embracing the digital retail landscape to successfully complement their brick-and-mortar business. So that is a very interesting, you know, statement unto itself. Remember that Performance was recently purchased, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Interbike, just as an aside, they're saying was down in attendance by over 12%. So, you know, who knows where it's all going.
And I think Performance is big enough that they can afford to play with that a little bit because they have enough brick and mortar as well as online. So hopefully they can figure it out quickly so the rest of the cycling industry can take advantage of that.
Exactly.
Found a post from Ray's Indoor Mountain Bike Place.
Oh, right here in Cleveland.
Yep. And this is a letter actually posted from Ray himself. Hello, riders. Now that we're back into another fall season at Ray's, I wanted to officially announce some news that's been floating around. Yes, I have bought back Ray's Cleveland from Trek Bicycle. Yes, we unfortunately had to close Milwaukee Ray's. I'm sick to my stomach over this horrible news. My original announcement about the fate of Ray's came in a post on Facebook also. First, he goes through a whole list of people that he would like to thank for everything that he's done and gotten to that point. And he hopes that you will visit and continue to support the park. And they're building new stuff. They have some great things going on. But Ray's is now Ray's again.
Well, and it was the first. It was the biggest. And hopefully it will come back around. It's under Ray's control again. So, you know, I'm wondering why he's apologizing, actually.
Yeah. You know how business owners are. They just sort of have that feeling that they try to do everything for everybody, and this one just didn't work.
It didn't work out. Yeah.
Well.
All right.
Yeah.
We will be right back after a break when we will talk with Niall Gangler of Pioneer Valley Frameworks out in Massachusetts. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Here we are again, and I gotta tell you, Jim, this match has me really concerned.
Here we have a powerful heavyweight, a train, weighing in at 6,000 tons. And this hasty lightweight challenger, a car, at just 1.5 tons.
This does not bode well for the car, or the people in it.
It's no contest. Every day, people are injured or killed trying to beat a train at rail crossings. See tracks, think train.
We'll be right back.
Hi, Niall. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. So you're in the throes of moving.
Oh, yes.
I hate moving.
Yeah, it's bad, but almost done. Almost done.
Oh, well, that's good. That's good. I know we haven't met personally, but Eric Weiss, who I said, I really want to talk to one of the New England frame builders for the Builders Ball. So tell me. And he said, oh, no, you have to talk to Pioneer Valley Frameworks, Niall Gangler.
Eric is the man, and he's done a lot for the East Coast Greenway, which is an awesome project. And, yeah, so I was flattered, and he's great.
Well, I feel as if I know a lot about you because you have a very comprehensive and beautifully laid out website. I'm very impressed with your website. Tell us a little bit about Niall's background, how you came to be a frame builder.
I've been obsessed with bikes since I was a little kid, and riding, all types of riding and racing, and loved bikes, and never thought it would be possible to build them at all. And I got into, when it was time to look for colleges, one of the schools I got accepted to was Hampshire College. And on the tour, the machine shop wasn't on the tour, but after the college like accepted tour, my dad and I wandered in there, and there were all these machines, Bridgeport milling machines and welding equipment, and all these people working on all this different amazing stuff. And a student at the time had built some frames, and I was like, oh my God. So I talked to Don Dupuy, who's awesome professor, and I said, so if I went to college here, you know, would it be possible for me to do this? And he's like, well, you know, it wouldn't be easy, but yep, technically you could do this. So I was like, oh my God, game on. So the second I ended up enrolling there, and the second I got there, I went into the shop and was like, all right, how do I learn to weld and machine and design bikes and all this? So I started in college, and then also did the United Bicycle Institute in Oregon, awesome titanium frame building class where everybody has their own welder. I mean, it was amazing. And then worked for Independent Fabrication for a little bit, and then took a Cerata fitting course, and so a bunch of different places learned. I'm still always trying to learn. I mean, I started in 03, but there's always learning. So, but yeah, started in college.
Well, what's really interesting is that it looks like you were born with the bicycle gene. We call that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. My husband's the same way. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You know, like from when he was a little boy. The other thing I found really interesting about your site is, number one, you keep it so that your frames sort of represent Massachusetts. It's kind of a really interesting way of approaching your work. Do you only build in steel, or do you build in tie also?
I've built in tie, but I don't currently offer it to customers. I'd like to bring tie into the mix in the future, but yeah, right now it's just steel. I mean, steel's just a fantastic material for a lot of reasons. Yeah, steel, and I'm glad you kind of picked up on the, I mean, as the company name Pioneer Valley Frameworks implies, you know, the riding out here is incredible, and it is a big part of what has influenced a lot of my frame designs and each of the kind of general models that you see on the website. The website, there's a lot of work underway. I'm glad you said you liked it, because there's still a lot of work to be done. So
there's always a lot of work to be done,
yeah,
you know.
Right. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about a couple of your frame choices. You seem to run the gamut. You'll build road, and you build cross, and you build randonneur, and you build
mean everything.
I like that.
You know, you talk to some people who are, you know, way into bikes and stuff, and they're very like, you know, this is the thing I do, and you know, I'm very open minded with bikes in general, and there's a lot of different ways to have a lot of fun on bikes, and I so there's pros and cons to all sorts of different genres of bikes and things you can do on them. So, yeah, I have some kind of set models now, as you're describing. But really, they're just starting points, too. I mean, I really focus on everything is fully custom. So everything I do is really built to the individual rider and exactly what they're going to do. So having these set models, a lot of them what you see is kind of like, okay, this is what I would personally use and set up for this type of riding. But really, you know, people need very different things. So really a lot of their starting points and things are tweaked every time to the individual person.
So you have a bike called the Greylock, which is your road.
Ooh, yes.
Yeah, it's pretty.
Very fun, fast bike.
Is it fast? Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, just all that kind of the Greylock's the classic, you know, fast, fun, sporty road bike. And again, you know, it can be customized. So somebody who wants a little more relaxed road position, that fits in that as well. So the Greylock is the road model, but typically it's, you know, built to be quite fast and racy. It's a very fun bike.
But you also have the Outbound, which is a touring and adventure bike, and I really like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the heavy-duty, you know, speed is not the goal of the Outbound. It's all about the versatility, utility, and just being able to do a bit of everything. And that's my main speed right now of my personal armada of bikes, you know, because you just don't have to plan in anything. It's got generator lights, fenders, racks, tires that will accommodate, you know, any kind of terrain. So you just go, and it's pretty hard to come up with excuses not to ride that bike because it doesn't care about bad weather.
It doesn't care about day, night, weather, and you can ride it year-round. Do you ever use internally geared hubs like the Roloff?
I haven't personally specced a Roloff. I have built up a belt drive frame in the past that someone did put an internally geared hub. There's definitely pros to them. I mean, it all depends on what you need the bike to do. They definitely are interesting for a all-weather, low-maintenance kind of deal. It makes sense for sure.
You will be at the Builders Ball tomorrow night?
I will, yeah.
Okay, what are you taking? Are you taking anything that nobody's seen yet?
Yeah, well, it's such a, you know, it's funny you ask that. So my personal bikes, I mean, I basically try to break them. You know, I beat the crap out of them. So anytime one of these shows comes up, I'm like, oh, God, I can't bring my bikes because, I mean, you know, I've just beat the crap out of them. So all the parts are always, you know, tons of scratches and I, you know, because I really use them. So, yeah, anytime one of these shows comes up, I'm like, okay, what customers? So I'm coordinating with a couple customers to steal their bikes. And you know, people are usually, they're excited about it. But I always feel bad because, you know, if it's a weekend and everybody's got plans to ride, I'm like, can I just borrow this? So yeah, borrowing a couple bikes just for the evening. One of them is, I mean, talk about somebody who doesn't want to part with his bike, but this guy who goes by the nickname High Mileage Steve, just amazingly inspiring guy. But I just built him a 29er, and so right now it's you know, around end of September, and he's got over 25,000 miles for the year.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
the guy eats and sleeps on it, huh?
That's what he does. Yeah, so he does 80 to 130 miles of trails and dirt roads a day. So he's been loving the bike I built him, and I'm going to snatch it end of the day and get it back in the evening so it can ride it Saturday morning.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Niall Gengler from Pioneer Valley Frameworks in Massachusetts. Are you taking more than one bike to the Builders Ball?
Yeah, I think I'll have three. I'm still trying to see. I'm going to try to avoid bringing mine because, like I said, they've seen some really tough love.
Yeah, but you know what? Tough love is good. It shows that the bike can take it and, you know.
Yeah, it is. I mean, those are the bikes I build. I I really build them to get used, and with the emphasis on, you know, people are getting these bikes to really ride them. So the downside is, you know, a dirty beat up bike in a bike show with some really brand new sparkling bikes doesn't really, you know, really these things are meant to be out on the road and on the trail. So putting them in a showroom is always a little funny. It's not their home environment.
Right, exactly. But they're not shy. They're fine. How many bikes approximately, and I don't want to hold you to this, but how many bikes do you usually try to build in a year, let's say?
Oh, it varies a ton. I mean, I'm definitely a low quantity. I've been building for 12 years in total. I'm up somewhere around 150 to 160 frames, which feels like a lot to me because it's been a lot of work and all sorts of stuff has gone into that. But, you know, you talk to different builders and they've done, you know, a bajillion bikes. So it really varies a lot. For me, I put a lot of emphasis on the design and fitting phase. So a lot of the projects, they're not fast to turn around. So I'm a lower quantity builder, I guess.
Let's talk just for a couple of minutes about how you'll do a fit. If somebody is finding you and not coming to you, are you able to do remote work, or are you suggesting they get their butts to East Hampton?
I always try to get them to come to me in person. It's possible. So, something like 95% of the builders up there, usually it's done often over the phone, and like torso inseam arm measurements and using formulas and stuff. And that'll build a sweet, cool, handmade bike, and something I think, you know, definitely better than what you get off the shelf. But really, in terms of a dialed fit, you know, it's just a starting point. So there's really no substitute to, you know, putting someone on a fitting bike and really seeing how their body responds in person. You know, because everybody has different levels of flexibility, what their previous riding history is, if they have a history of injuries. There's really no substitute for seeing them in person. So, yeah, I mainly build bikes for people in New England. I've had some people fly to come in, which has been awesome. I can do, you know, the standard, what I call semi-custom, is the, you know, inseam torso arm length, and someone could be in California or something, and I can do that. I love to, really a huge part of the process for me is the in-person fitting, and really getting to know the customer and really understand. You know, people use bikes and need to use bikes in really different ways. So to be able to sit down with them and really get to understand what they want the bike to do. And then, you know, you put them on the fitting bike. And part of what's so fun about that process is even, you know, people who have been racing and riding for years, it's so rare I don't tweak something with a fit to improve it. And part of what's so cool is, you know, it's a stationary bike inside. It's not outside. But they feel that difference. You can hear, you know, I have a power readout on the fitting bike. And, like, you see, it's like, wow, the person's spitting out more watts than when they first came in. And you know, of course, they get excited. I get excited because they get this glimpse of, like, oh, my God, this is what I've been missing. And it's this glimpse of what the bike, when it's finished, is going to help do for them. And that's only part of, you know, then you add custom geometry to it that you handle how they want, how they're going to ride. So it's a really exciting part of the fitting and kind of rider interview part is a really exciting part of the process for me.
Yep. I don't quite get the remote fitting, because it's the nuances of that little bit of, well, gee, you know, your hip is dropping a little bit too much on that side. And, you know, so what's causing that? Just so I think that's really, really
cool.
Yeah,
you get it. Yeah.
Oh, no, totally. I do. I do. I absolutely do. And I appreciate that somebody else gets it and was able to explain it as well as you did.
It's bizarre as sinners, though, right? Because there's so many people that I don't understand. Because, you know, the fit is the connection between the person, the engine, and the machine, and it's like you can spend so much money on a bike off the shelf, wherever. If you're not going to have a fitting, you're losing all of this performance, let alone, you know, comfort and also injury prevention. But I'm sure it baffles you as well. I mean, there's so many people I know who have been riding forever, and they're like, oh, fit? Why would you do that? And then you finally get them to come in, and they're like, oh.
That's what you meant. Right. Right. Let our listeners know how they can find you, and then we will direct them there. And then I also like to know, what's your lead time on a frame these days?
Yeah, sure. So to find me, I have a website. It is pioneerframeworks.com. And then you can call or email with any questions. There's also links if you want to check out kind of what's going on with projects, rides, to follow on social media on various platforms. And then lead time varies, but right now, end of September, orders right now with the current queue finished around beginning to mid-spring is, I think, where I'm at right now.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time in your busy schedule to get ready for Builder's Ball. Not only Builder's Ball, but you're moving. So good luck with your move. Good luck with the weekend. And good luck with your business. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye. Ah, Niall Gengler. He's so cute.
I would rather see a bike that's got a few scratches on it and that's been road tested and everything else than something that's perfect. And
heck yeah. Heck yeah. I mean, his bikes are very pretty. We sort of are kindred spirits in the way we think about fit and cycling. So it was really nice to talk to him. He will be at the Builder's Ball, or by the time you hear this, the Builder's Ball will be over. But it's Pioneer Frameworks in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Well, that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed our guests, superstar cyclocross champion Jeremy Powers, frame builder Niall Gengler, and recumbent CycleCon's director Charles Coyne. We will be back next week with a brand new show. I hope you're safe. I hope you're having fun. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.